Today we're going to be reviewing the book of Habakkuk. As I mentioned in an email that I sent yesterday, and to that email I attached a copy of the Life, Hope, and Truth article that Mr. Von Belkum has written that summarizes this particular minor prophet. I have read through the article, and I will not be following the same course that he takes in his summary of the book, but the information I hope will be complementary to what he has, what he's provided for us there. It's nice that we're building up quite a library of overviews of books of the Bible and working our way through. So eventually, of course, we'll have a separate article that will provide at least an overview of each book in the Bible. I think we have a complete set of the minor prophets already. So there are some copies of that article at the information table for any of you who did not receive a copy by email yesterday. The book of Habakkuk is not one that we look at often. We've said that about a number of the minor prophets as we have gotten to them. This is number 9 in our series. We'll have 3 more. The books of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi still to cover after today. So we're making progress through, and we're going to spend this morning here in the book of Habakkuk. It's not a real familiar book necessarily, but we're going to find at least 2 passages as we go through this book. And if you've read it ahead of time, you probably have already identified them, that are extremely familiar and very important concepts to us. Now, that's not that all of God's Word or any part of it is not important, but sometimes we look for what we call memory scriptures and verses that open up really important teaching concepts. We'll find a couple of those here in this book. We know nothing about the man Habakkuk. We speculate some about him due to the structure and the way that the book is written. It appears that he was a poet, perhaps a musician. The second chapter is much of it is in the form of a poem or in poetic form, and then the last chapter 3 is introduced as a psalm. Some have speculated that he may have been a Levite. One of the many musicians were actually full-time employed, so to speak, at the temple. There were professional musicians who were at the temple. Perhaps that would be a role that Habakkuk filled. Although, again, there's no specific mention either of either of those. It's kind of reading that, speculating on that, based on maybe historical references or the way that the book is put together for us. The name Habakkuk in the Hebrew means embrace. And the implication is that he was embraced by God and also that he embraced God. We'll see that it's a kind of an interactive book. Habakkuk has some questions and he's concerned about things that are happening and that he's observing. And he brings those questions to God and God answers. And so there's kind of an interactive format or structure to the book. And throughout, even though Habakkuk is asking questions, he's not doing so in a way that seems like he's doubting or that he's accusing God in any way or being disrespectful. But he has some very deep and serious concerns about things that he's observed. God, we'll see, not only answered him, but he also instructed Habakkuk to write the answers in a large format so that everyone would know what those answers are. So God was very directly involved with Habakkuk in a very direct way. The time that the book was written, and also just the approach that is taken, makes it clear that Habakkuk was writing to the people of Judah. It does not say that specifically in the book, but it's clear from the context and the way that things are stated, and again specifically the timing of the book. It does, however, have, as many of the prophecies do, a general application to both Israel and Judah, and in particular at the end of the age. This short book was probably written a short time before Nebuchadnezzar invaded Judah. And we know that that occurred in the year 605. That took place actually over a period of some 20 years. There were three separate invasions. The first of them was in the year 605. So this book appears to have been written just shortly before that first invasion. I gave you a timeline, a chronological timeline, as a handout at the beginning of our series of studies. And I show on that that the time frame for this book is between 627 and 585 B.C. That's quite a range of time. It was most likely written earlier in that time frame rather than later. But again, note that the invasions of Judah occurred starting in 605 and continued to 585. So it was right during or just before the time of that invasion that Habakkuk has recorded his prophecy. Some have dated the writing to be possibly as early as about the year 607 to 606, which would make it just immediately before that first invasion. So regardless of whether the specific year, Habakkuk wrote at a time when the nation was right on the edge, teetering on the edge of disaster, or perhaps sometime after some of the early invasion had actually begun. Most likely, again, just before that first invasion would be the most likely time that he wrote the book. As we read it and we look at the questions that Habakkuk has, it reminds me a lot. You know, sometimes we look for how is a book like this relevant to us? You know, this a name almost as odd as some of the ones Mr. Ball was talking about, and just kind of it's not a familiar book at all, not something that we look at a lot. How is that relevant? Well, I think we find that there's a lot of relevance, a great deal of relevance to this particular prophet, because his questions and his concerns remind me a great deal of the conditions that we see developing in our nation and in the world around us. We see a nation that is coming unraveled. You've noticed, I'm sure. I think we've reached the threshold of a new level of normal, and that is this extreme anger that people have begun to express, whether it's in demonstrations over a court decision or whether it's just horrible crimes that are being committed in politics for sure. There's a higher level of just anger in the world around us. And we know who the author of anger is or the source of it is, that Satan is he. And we're told even in Revelation 12 that there's going to come a time when he's going to be enraged and attack the church in particular, the world in general. He's an angry being. And it kind of notches up a little bit at a time. It's the old frog in the pot of water. It's a little bit more dangerous now than it was a year ago. More concern about terrorism attacks. More concern about just random attacks of terrorists. And I mean, it's the whole thing is just reaching a higher level. Consistently. And that's the kind of thing that Habakkuk noted was happening in his world. It was happening to his nation. And he was greatly concerned about that. We'll see that as we get into the book. He was probably contemporary with Jeremiah, Nahum, and Zephaniah. And again, you can see that on the timeline that I gave you. They're at least overlapped with and was contemporary with them in terms of the time that they were doing their work. There's no indication that they ever crossed paths, but we don't know really if there was a connection or a relationship between God's prophets during that time frame. Habakkuk has two primary questions that we'll get to those as we go. But the first question is, why, God, do you allow such evil and violence in your nation? Why do you allow that? And, you know, again, we can look at what's happening, watch the news, in what's happening in our world, in our nation, and we wonder why. You know, it just hurts to see. And it even creates a sense of anxiety and concern for the condition that our nation is headed into. But Habakkuk wanted to know, well, why do you allow that, God? Why what's the purpose of that? And secondly, the second question that he asked, a number of them, but the second primary question is, why will you punish your people with a nation that's even more evil than Judah? This nation of Babylon was right there. The clouds were on the horizon. The storm was on the horizon. They could see it coming. And they'd been warned about it by other prophets. So Habakkuk had a sense of what was going to happen. And he was asking, well, God, why would you, your people are bad enough, but why would you use someone even worse to punish them? And so those were the concerns that he expresses in this in his prophecies. A little more thought about the chronology or the timing of the book. He wrote at a time after the nation of Israel had gone into captivity. That much is clear. And there was a power shift that took place in the region in the late 600s. That is, beginning in about the year 612 B.C., that was the year that Babylon destroyed the city of Nineveh. Nineveh was a major city of the Assyrians. And it was in the year 612 that Babylon was beginning then to overtake and to take the place of Assyria as the dominant conquering nation. 612, they destroyed Nineveh. You may recall also from the story in Chronicles and in Kings that when Assyria's armies overtook Israel, they intended at that time to come on into and also to attack Judah, but they were prevented from doing so. And so now, 120 years or so later, Assyria is on the decline, being replaced by Babylon. In a series of battles between 609 and 605, Babylon vanquished Assyria and Egypt, and during that time period then became the dominant force, the dominant conquering military power in that part of the world. And then after they had polished off Assyria in 605, that's when they came on into and began their attacks on the nation of Judah. So it's in this time frame, just as he sees all this about to happen, that Habakkuk is writing. Again, I talked about relevance in this book. We talked about the conditions that he was looking at and that we have to, that we see happening around us. One central lesson of the book is patience and faith. That's a lesson that Habakkuk is reminded of, and one that is repeated a number of times later in Paul's writings, the importance of patience and faith. We know that God has a plan. And, you know, we talk often about how, we want the kingdom to come, we want Christ to return, but what has to happen between now and then is pretty frightening. And it is. It's a very sobering thing. But we must have, if this is happening in our age, and it very well could, if all that takes place in our lifetime, it's going to require a great deal of faith and patience to watch those events happen, and they will have an impact on us, and we must be willing to endure patiently and wait for that plan to unfold. That essentially is the message that God gave to Habakkuk. That these things are going to happen. And we must be patient and live on faith as we look to God as those events do take place. And just one other thought, we can also take that same concept of patiently enduring, even when we are dealing with our personal trials. This is talking, the primary point of the book of Habakkuk is the national punishment that's going to come on Judah. But we deal with personally things, too, that are very difficult and very worrisome. And we must be patient. We must exercise faith as those events take place in our lives personally as well, the personal things that happen to us. So, as with any of what God has preserved for us in Scripture, there's very much in this little book for us to think about and to learn from. Let's begin in chapter 1, the burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw. The prophecies what the prophets delivered is often called a burden. It's a special, it's just a way of expressing the importance of and the heaviness of the what it is that God revealed through them to us. So he begins right off with the first question, verse 2. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and you will not hear? Even cry out to you violence, and you will not save. Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me. There is strife and contention arises. Therefore the law is powerless, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore perverse judgment proceeds. In these opening verses, Habakkuk is posing that question. God, why don't you do something to stop what's going on? The violence, the injustice, the lawlessness. It's interesting to consider also what was happening in Judah at the time that he was making these observations. Josiah was the last righteous king of Judah. And his reign continued clear up to about the year 609. So this was within Habakkuk's observations are made within just a few years after this extremely righteous king had ruled in Judah. And so we might wonder, well, how did it turn so quickly? How did things get so bad in that short a time frame? Jehoiakim is the king when Habakkuk is writing. He was evil. But again, how did it turn so quickly? Well, you may have noticed if you're watching the FI classes, Dr. Levy made a comment in one of the earlier classes when speculating on, well, why didn't Jeremiah, who was doing his work at this time, why didn't he work more closely with Josiah? Why doesn't it seem as if they worked together? Because they had a righteous king and a righteous prophet, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of connection there. Dr. Levy speculated that possibly, the two reasons probably or likely, one is that the religious renewal that King Josiah was leading was probably superficial. Probably didn't go real deep. And secondly, even if Josiah himself had a real deep commitment, the people didn't. For the people, they went along with it. You can see the stories of the days, holy days they observed, and restoring the temple and so on. But you know, it didn't probably reach much outside of the immediate area of Jerusalem, and the people themselves, the nation, didn't really turn around, even though their king was one who was restoring and renewing their understanding of God's, their covenant with God. So, you know, when a righteous man is replaced by really a series, you see within these last 20 years before the final destruction of Judah, a whole series of evil kings. It doesn't take long for a society to turn and to come into the conditions here that Habakkuk was worried by. He was saddened by the corruption, the violence that he saw all around them, and was asking God, you know, why can't why can't you stop this? There's so much suffering that's happening here. The phrase here that the law is powerless means that the application of the law was ineffective. Judah was supposed to be God's nation, operating under the laws of God, both civil laws and laws of, I guess you call them spiritual laws of worship of God. But they were not being administered. They're not being practiced. And other of the prophets that we've read emphasized how the people mistreated each other. And that was just as much a reason for their punishment as the fact that they were disobeying God. So the answer begins in verse 5. God begins to answer the question that Habakkuk has laid before him. He says, look among the nations and watch, be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe, even though I told you. For indeed I'm raising up the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans are the leading class or the leadership class of the nation of Babylon. Sometimes they are. It's the Chaldeans that we refer to the Babylonian people or nation. I'm raising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They're terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity proceed from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards and more fierce than evening wolves. Their chargers charge ahead. Their cavalry comes from afar. They fly as the eagle that hastens to eat. They all come for violence. Their faces are set like the east wind. They gather captives like sand. So, not really very comforting words, but God is expressing to Habakkuk that, you know, hold on, because here it comes. And this is of me, is the point that he's making. That God was preparing in Habakkuk's time to use the Babylonians to destroy the nation of Judah. And they are, verse 7, terrible and dreadful and violent. And they would cause a great deal of harm to the people in the way that they would attack them. So the answer so far to Habakkuk is just that, well, first of all, again, back in verse 5, his I will work a work. This is of God. This is something that he is going to do. It's not just happening. It's not just a circumstance. It's not something that's done by men and not in their plans. This is something that God is responsible for. And he says it's a work that you would not believe, even though it was told to you. So it's going to be even worse than he could imagine, is really what the message to him is. Again, I think we can see that there's a parallel between what happened in Habakkuk's time or in Judah's time and what will happen again at the end of the age. We're warned that it will be a time that's unparalleled and in difficulty and in destructiveness. And so the immediate application was to Habakkuk and to Judah, but we can see that there is a parallel as well that will occur later. But God is in control. This is his plan. He will not fail. He will accomplish it. It's hard for us to keep that in mind when certain things happen, whether it's to us personally or whether it's what we see happening in our nation or in the world around us, that God really is in charge. And God will use nations, as he was in this case, to raise up an entire nation to come and do something to accomplish what he wants done. So that's at least the answer we see thus far to his question. Verses 10 and 11 continue on then describing the nation that God will use to punish Judah. So God's answer to Habakkuk's initial question is in verses 5 through 11. And then in verse 12, on to the end of the first chapter, Habakkuk basically responds to God's answer. And, you know, it leads him to another question, frankly. He says, first of all, praising God and recognizing his authority. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have appointed them for judgment. You have marked them for correction. In other words, God will, in God's plan, that there's the suffering that will come, but there will be survivors that God will see and bring through that circumstance. But this description of Babylon, and I'm sure that they were aware of what the nation was like, even through other experience or source or news about them, brought another serious question to Habakkuk's mind. You are of purer eyes than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness. So Judah is going to be punished because God can't abide with what they are doing, what they're practicing. So here's the question. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when the wicked devours a person more righteous than he? Why will you punish your people with a nation that's even more wicked than they are? So he's expressing an understanding and appreciation for who his God is. That God can't abide with evil. He can't accept what's happening. But Habakkuk can't help but ask, well, but why them? Why are you doing it this way? Why do you make men like fish of the sea, like creeping things that have no ruler over them? They take up all of them with a hook. They catch them in their net. They gather them in the dragnet. Therefore, they rejoice and are glad. In other words, these people that you're going to use are like animals. They're out of control. They have no moral responsibility or care. They're just like savage creatures that hurt almost randomly. They sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their dragnet. Because their share is sumptuous and their food is plentiful. These unscrupulous and violent people prosper in what they're doing, and they rejoice in it. So it's kind of even rubbing more insult or salt into the hurt of Judah, that they do this and they rejoice in it and they gloat over it, and as they just act like these savage animals. Shall they therefore empty their net and continue to slay nations without pity? God, are you going to let them continue to get away with this? Now, on the one hand, I'm sure Habakkuk understood that, yeah, that's what God just said he was going to do. But it's more of a just an emotional, it's an expression of his hurt for his people and for the human unfairness of it all. So Habakkuk is a very human man, human guy. You know, he's really, he has feelings that we can relate to, as he's watching all this unfold in the world and in the nation that he loves. So the thought continues into the next verse. He says, "I'll stand." He's asked these questions. Okay, so he's asked, you know, why don't you intervene to stop all this terrible violence and this suffering, and why are you using people even more evil than Judah to punish your nation? So then he says, verse 1 of chapter 2, I'll just stand my watch and set myself on the rampart and watch to see what you will say and what I will answer when I'm corrected. So again, a very kind of a human kind of an approach I think we can relate to, that, you know, God, I've asked my questions and I'm just going to stand back now and wait for the answer, and then I'll have to respond when you correct me. And so he's very it's a very, very kind of a normal human approach that he's taking here, but one that is a respectful and worshipful, and he accepts that God is the one who's in charge, but it's just so painful for him to see it and to have to endure it. So verse 2, then the Lord answered me, and he said, write the vision and make it plain on tablets, that he may run who reads it. So again, the answer, God says, okay, I'm going to give you the answer, and I want you to write it down in great big letters, so even somebody who's running down the road will be able to see and understand what the answer is. It's like, you know, like a billboard on the side of the highway, something that people would be able to recognize. So in some kind of a large format. Verse 3, for the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it will speak and it will not lie. So what you're about to, what God is going to reveal to him is something that is yet to be fulfilled. And it says, at the end it will speak. And so, again, that should, I think, help us to see that this is the answer is given on two levels. It's an immediate answer for what is going to happen to Judah in Habakkuk's time. And secondly, at the end it will speak. In other words, there's more to it than this. And it's a prophecy of something that goes clear to another whole stage in God's plan, what he will accomplish. And it seems like it's going to take time, but it will come. It will surely come. And when it does, it will not tarry. When it does, when it happens, it'll happen. And so there's the assurance from God that this is of me. This is going to happen. It'll happen now, and it'll happen in some form also at the end. In verse 4, we come to one of those points that we recognize very clearly. May not have realized it was written initially in the book of Habakkuk, but it's something that we are very familiar with. Behold the proud, his soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. Contrasting those who are unfaithful with those who are faithful. The proud trust in themselves, and we know that they will ultimately fail. But the righteous, the just, live by faith. Faith in what? Faith in God. Faith in his statements and his assurances that this is going to happen, but it's of him, and that there's something beyond it, which he's already said is so great that you wouldn't even know it if I tried to tell you. So this is a key concept that carries over and is repeated. In fact, it's a few times in the New Testament. I'll just list a couple of them. Romans 1:17, Galatians 3:11. Paul makes the same point. He makes the statement in 2 Corinthians 5:7 that we walk by faith, not by sight. In Paul's writings, he tends to kind of summarize, paraphrase the principle. But the point is made, and it's something that we're very much aware of. It's a point that I think we think of often, that we live by faith. And when things happen in our lives or when things happen in the world around us, when things that take place that seem to be out of control or that we don't, we certainly wouldn't want to be happening, we stand back and we live by faith, not by sight. I've often referred to the experience that Peter had when in the storm that one evening they were out on the boat and Christ walked on the water out to the boat. Peter said, if it's you, call me and I'll walk out to you. And when Peter and Christ said, you know, sure, come and join me. And Peter was able to walk on the water as long as he looked at Jesus Christ. But it says that he looked away and he saw the waves. He saw the storm and he became frightened by the circumstances and then he sunk. And that's the way it is for us. There are many things that happen in our lives that are frightening, that are very worrisome. If we look at those circumstances, then we'll panic like anybody else would. but we're able to continue as long as we look to Jesus Christ. And it's a lesson we learn over and over and over again. But the just will live by his faith. And, I guess we can talk about his faith. Is it God's faith? Is it our faith? I don't know that that's really a big issue. We have to have faith in order to please God, as we know from Hebrews 11. And so in order to survive whatever the circumstances are in our lives personally or in the world as it's coming unglued around us, we live by faith. We live by our trust in God. He will complete his plan, and we are part of it. I might just note in one of the places where this verse is quoted. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 10. We don't know for sure who wrote the book of Hebrews. Could have been Paul. May have been another person that isn't identified. But the point is made here, which fits very well with what Habakkuk is writing. Hebrews 10, verse 35. Breaking into the middle of this flow here, which is talking about living according to our faith. Verse 35, therefore do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that after you've done the will of God, you may receive the promise. So we have to continue in what the circumstances are in our lives or in the world that we live in, not losing our confidence that God is in charge and he'll see everything through, and still being willing to endure. Verse 37, for yet a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, but if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. Again, a paraphrase of what we find here in the book in Habakkuk 2, that it's not going to be delayed forever. It will happen, and we must live by faith. The prophecy specifically to Habakkuk about these times, but again, we apply it in our lives in a personal way also. We might also just make note, I won't turn to these references, but there are a couple of psalms that speak of the dilemma that we sometimes observe, that wicked people seem to prosper and righteous people seem to have difficulties. And it just is unbalanced. It's not fair. That concern is addressed in Psalm 37 and also in Psalm 73. Those two psalms both emphasize that, yeah, for a while, wicked people prosper. But ultimately, they fail, and those who are righteous will succeed. But when we're in the middle of it, you know, and we're struggling to do what's right, and others around us outside of God's way of life are practicing just evil and wicked things, and they seem to be having a great time and making lots of money doing it, it kind of makes you a little bit crazy. But the point is that just wait. Just be patient. Live by your faith, because those who practice that wickedness will someday reap what they've sown. So the just will live by his faith. That's a whole sermon, a whole Bible study in itself. Verse 5 again describes the conquering nation of Babylon. Indeed, because he transgresses by wine, he's a proud man, he does not stay at home. So he enlarges his desires as the grave. He's like death, he cannot be satisfied. It's just all these terrible, evil things about this people. And but yet they seem, at least at the moment, to have the upper hand. Will not all these take up a proverb against him and a taunting riddle against him and say, woe to him who increases what is not his? So this begins, now it's kind of hard to see this in our English translations of the Bible, but it actually begins a poem. And the poem has five stanzas in it. And each stanza in this poem begins with the word woe. And it so it's describing the, what will ultimately be the result of the people of Babylon, or maybe evil people in general, and how they will not always have that upper hand. The first stanza of this poem is in verses 6 through 8. And so again, this is perhaps an indication that that Habakkuk was kind of a poet, or maybe the last chapter again is in a psalm, so he had some of that creative skill. But woe to him who increases what is not his. How long? And to him who loads himself with many pledges, will not your creditors rise up suddenly and awaken to oppress you, and you become their booty? Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the people shall plunder you. So the people who are going to be used here to punish Judah will ultimately have their own punishment. Verse 9, again, another warning to the people of Babylon. Woe to him who covets evil gain for his house, that he may set his nest on high. Those who covet and build their lives on wealth will eventually meet, that will come to an end. This is a condemnation of Babylon, but frankly it's to anybody in any time who happens to choose to live this way. Babylon was the nation that would be punished. This being spoken of here. But anyone who lives by these standards will eventually have this kind of a result in their life. Verse 12, woe to him who builds a town with bloodshed, who establishes a city by iniquity. It is not of the Lord of hosts that the people's labor... Is it not of the Lord of hosts that people labor to feed the fire, and nations weary themselves in vain? What they build will fail, and God will see to it that that will happen. God will see to it that they come meet their end. Verse 14 is another, the second of these two verses that I wanted to emphasize that we may not have realized is stated here because we read it elsewhere and we're very familiar. Verse 14. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Eternal as the waters cover the seas. Now, that's almost word for word what we read in Isaiah 11, verse 9. And Isaiah 11 is where we're accustomed to seeing it. But here, it kind of stands out in this whole context of the ultimate or eventual punishment of Babylon. And it's an assurance that, you know what, not only are they going to meet their end, but there's a promise here, a millennial promise, that all of the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the seas. In other words, the world is going to be saturated with the way of God and under the leadership of Jesus Christ. Verse 15, woe to him who gives drink to his neighbor, pressing him to your bottle, even to make him drunk, that you may take advantage of him, look on his nakedness. So it's kind of condemning them for their lifestyle of self-indulgence and of sinfulness. And it's a shameful way to live, it says in verse 16. The cup of the Lord's right hand will be turned against you, and utter shame will be on your glory. So God will turn the tables on those who live this way. And again, it's some consolation to Habakkuk that, yeah, that these are people that you, as you say, are even more evil than the people of Judah, but, and I'm using them to punish your people, but they're not going to get away with this for long. They will also be punished. The last of these five stanzas begins a little bit differently than the others. Verse 18 is the last stanza in this poem, in this chapter. What profit is the image that its maker should carve it? So now it's a condemnation of idolatry. But verse 19 says, woe to him who worships the idol. So there's a woe here, but it's in the second sentence of this last stanza. So a little bit different in its presentation. But it's still, it's the last verse of the standard verses 18, last stanza of this poem in verses 18 and 19, the condemnation of the idolatry which Babylon practiced as well. So verse 20 again is the final statement of assurance once more. It says, but the Eternal is in his temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. For all that happens, be it in our personal life, be it in our nation, be it in the world around us, God is on his throne. He is working his plan. And we should all just stand back and be quiet and watch and have faith in God completing that plan that he is devoted to. Chapter 3, then, is an acknowledgement by Hezekiah of the answers that God has given him. Since it's a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet. And so, having asked his questions, having received his answers, Habakkuk then praises God for his power and his authority as he finishes his prophecy. It's written in very poetic and symbolic language. It's easy to read. It's sometimes hard to understand all the similes and the comparisons he's making, or maybe the historical references that are included. But it's a matter of praising God for the answers that he's given and for the plan that God will succeed in. O Eternal, verse 2, I've heard your speech and was afraid. As I said, some of the words that were given in answer to him, I guess we can say they were comforting because they came from God and answered the question. But yeah, there's some things that he said that are frightening, that are worrisome. It's just like our understanding of end-time prophecy as well. I've heard what you said, and I was afraid. O Eternal, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of their years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. So it's kind of an acknowledgement that, you know, you've given me the answer, and I find some comfort in it, but wow, there's some serious things that are going to happen here, and just beg you to remember mercy as you express your wrath. Then the next few verses, it's kind of a generalized and poetic summary of some of the things God has done and the work that he's performed in the history of Israel. His glory covered the heavens and earth was full of praise. Verse 4, his brightness was like the light, his rays flashing from his hand, and his power... And there his power was hidden. Before him went pestilence, and fever followed his feet. He stood and measured the earth. This is a generalized, poetic expression of the ways in which God has dealt with, and cared for, and led his people through the time up to Habakkuk's time. Verse 8, O Lord, were you displeased with the rivers? Was your anger against the rivers, a wrath against the sea? Your bow was made quite ready. Oaths were sworn over your arrows. So it's talking about, again, punishment that was also brought upon them at different times. God punished his Judah. God will punish the other nations. It's an acknowledgement and an expression of what God has done in working with all the nations, including Judah. Verse 12, you marched through the land in indignation. You trampled the nations in anger. You went forth for the salvation of your people and for salvation with your anointed. This is a description of the kinds of things that will happen when God intervenes at the end of the age, the day of the Lord. You marched through the land. You trampled the nations. You went forth for the salvation of your people. And you struck the head of the house of the wicked. So it's a description of the kinds of ways that Jesus Christ will intervene in punishing not only Israel, nations of Israel, which includes Judah, but the other nations at the end of the age. mentioned the same thought is included in verse 16 as well. It says, when I heard, my body trembled. When the previous verses talk about the punishment again that came upon the people at God's hand. When I heard, my body trembled, my lips quivered at the voice, rottenness entered my bones. In other words, a deep sense of anxiety. And I trembled in myself that I might rest in the day of trouble. The day of trouble, Jacob's trouble is mentioned in Jeremiah 30. The day of the great tribulation, mentioned in Matthew 21. This is another reference to the time when Jesus Christ will punish all the nations. So Habakkuk understood from the answers that he was given that the punishment would begin on Judah, but would then extend to the other nations as well. And that's exactly the pattern that takes place at the end of the age. First, the great tribulation comes on the nations of Israel and on the remnant of the church. And then, during the time, the last year of that stage, the seventh trumpet, is when Jesus Christ begins to intervene and he punishes the rest of the nations. Verse 18, I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord is my strength. He will make my feet like deer's feet. He'll make me walk on high hills. So he concludes this short book or prophecy with, again, an expression of his faith in what God is accomplishing, and that God will not fail him. He will not fail his nation. He will not fail the world. God is the source of strength, the source of security. And it emphasizes once more the idea that we live by faith. We live by our trust in God, regardless sometimes of the circumstances. And in some cases, circumstances he has brought intentionally upon his people so that he can accomplish his plan for them. So, again, to me it's interesting that a book that seems pretty obscure really is filled with so much relevance, and just the lessons that we learn and the reactions that Habakkuk had to what was happening and even to the answers that are given to him, we can, I think, understand and relate to very clearly. So that will wrap up our discussion of this particular book. We have, as I said, three more to go. The book of Haggai is also an interesting one. It relates to some of the history of Judah. Now, this is the last of the prophets that write before the time of Judah's punishment. When we discuss, we read the books of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Those are called the post-exilic prophets, post or after the exile, after the captivity. When we read the book of Haggai, we'll see that that's talking about a time when the temple was being rebuilt after they returned from captivity. And Zechariah and Malachi also written following the completion of the captivity of Judah. So we've kind of gone through several books that are before that lead up to the punishment, and then we'll get into some prophets now that follow after that punishment has been completed. So that'll take care of our discussion then of Habakkuk and conclude this study for today.